I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
It's time to play like a Jet
with your host, Scott Mason.
Play like a Jet. What does that mean?
Drops the throw, steps up, floats a bomb up the right seam, looking for Anderson. He's got it. They're not going to catch him. He's going to go the distance. Touchdown. Sam Darnold dials it up to Robbie Anderson. 92 yards.
Anderson, too much deflected.
Bell into the middle of that line, and it's a touchdown.
Big return for Crowder, 85 yards.
Pass thrown, there was contact with the quarterback, and it's incomplete. They got pressure on Prescott. It was Adams who came blitzing in.
Hill hit immediately when he got the handoff.
You know who that's?
The Q-inator.
Oh my gosh.
Listen, thank you.
From the TOJ Digital Studios, this is Play Like a Jet, and it is time for the Jets-Redskins pregame report. My name is Scott Mason. You can follow me on Twitter, at PlayLikeAJet1, and we're going to answer some more questions, get the injury report from Dr. Stoller, gambling picks from my brother Craig, and a whole bunch more with the owner, the operator, the lead reporter, the whole shebang over at JetsInsider.com, and of course, above all of that, a very big deal, Mr. Chris Nimbley. So let's jump right back into the mailbag. Next question comes in from Jim Whiskey 3. He says, don't even want to have to type this, but the moronic Johnson's decision calls for it. Now that Gase will be back, is there any real hope it ends up being the right move? Any reason to think Gase improves and learns from his mistakes going forward? I'm skeptical. Please help me believe. SOS, I need to feel better. Probably not. I hate to be that guy, the wet blanket, but probably not. We saw this in Miami for 3 years. We're seeing more and more of his stubbornness here with the Jets. I've seen no signs that he's learned anything or that he's willing to change whatsoever. Even his answers to the press, I'm still astounded at the fact that when people point out to him that the team is the 32nd ranked offense in the league, his response is, I'm not really a stats guy. That to him is basically saying, shut up, I don't care about you, go away, you're just a beat reporter, I don't need to answer to you or the fans, I'm Mr. Football, get out of my way. And to me, that's a big problem. I also think it's a big problem that he doesn't seem to be willing to listen to anybody else. If it were me and I were Gase, I would probably at this point really desperately be looking for help from other people on the staff and how to turn things around, especially on the offensive side of the ball. But he is this offensive guru. Offense is his thing. His pride will never allow him to do that. We're seeing the same thing with Freddie Kitchens in Cleveland. I know that Cleveland is a little bit better off and they did just beat the Steelers, but still that offense has struggled quite a bit this year. He's got Todd Monk in there. Doesn't seem to be picking his brain in a way that you would think. So to answer your question, unfortunately, I don't really think there is a lot of hope that he is the right guy. The only thing that you can truly hope for here is that Joe Douglas builds a good enough roster and that Sam Darnold turns into a good enough quarterback. That Gase not being that good of a coach doesn't matter as much as it might under other circumstances. As Chris said before, if you believe that Adam Gase is the Andy Dalton of coaches, if Darnold is really, really good and if Douglas gives him a really good roster, then the Jets might be okay.
Yeah, so you just nailed it at the end there. I'll go through a little bit. Number one, hey, Adam, I'm not a stats guy either. I hate stats. I hate when people use stats as some type of snapshot because it's devoid of all context. Mm-hmm. But when consistently, year after year, you're at the bottom of the league in offense, it's really hard to sit here and call you some type of offensive genius, offensive guru. Year after year, and it's always an excuse. And the only time you've ever had that elite offense was when Peyton Manning, later in his career, was running the show. So I'm not a stats guy either. I hate when people use them to try to be like, hey, well, just look at these stats. And it's just like, all right, but there's way more goes into this. But this is the key. Because the biggest problem with Gase, and this is why I think, especially first time coaches when he was in Miami. You go somewhere and you fail, you need at least a year off from being a head coach, because mm-hmm. you need to be able to learn from the lessons of why you failed and be able to go back. I think it's such a huge mistake to hire fired coaches right after they were fired from their first gig. Let them go be a coordinator somewhere and learn some lessons. But they didn't do that. Gase has not learned those stuff, those lessons. It's very obvious he has not learned those lessons. He has not changed a single thing about him. And we talked about this before we thought Gase was getting the hire. All the problems we laid out saying were potential problems have become very real problems here. The only thing you can bank on is Joe Douglas. Joe Douglas and Sam Darnold, you got to hope that Joe Douglas builds a good enough roster around, and that with that improvement, Sam will improve enough so that Adam Gase can be Andy Dalton with everything good around him.
Next question comes in from John McAnally. He says, can we take a moment to thank Rex Ryan and marvel at how he was able to make this putrid franchise relevant and change the whole attitude about the team, even if it was only for a few years? The further away we get, the more amazing that feat feels. So as much as I enjoyed Rex's personality when things were going well, a lot of people romanticize the Rex years a little too much, only in the sense that they give him far too much credit for things going well. Now, listen, there were things that he did that were good. I like the fact that he had the players pumped up and ready to run through a wall for him. And if you talk to players that played for Rex, you've heard plenty of them on this show. One of them is Thomas Jones. He said he literally would have run through a wall for Rex. You heard Mike DeVito say something similar. Jamal Westerman loves Rex Ryan. To this day, we'll talk very warmly about Rex Ryan. That's positive. But as far as the development of the roster, yes, he did bring in Bart Scott and Jim Leonard with him, and that was good. But let's be real about this, and people don't want to remember it this way, but it's the truth. The core of those teams that went to the two AFC championship games were built when Eric Mangini was here and he was working with Mike Tannenbaum. And I'll tell you something, there are people that will say Mangini gets a little too much credit now retroactively. Obviously, we'll never know for sure exactly how much Mangini was the one pulling the strings, how much of it was Bradway, how much of it was Tannenbaum. But what I can tell you is that the results speak for themselves. There was some real synergy there, and Tannenbaum and Mangini worked really well together putting that roster together. And that team was ready to win when Rex came in. Mangini was fired after a 9-7 season, and it was largely because he lost the locker room. Players had had enough, and it was a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about with Gase that Mangini then brought with him to Cleveland to back up Chris's point about a head coach getting fired from his first gig and right away jumping into another one and it never working out. He took the same mentality to Cleveland, and it bombed badly, and he was out of there real quickly and never had another opportunity. But as far as building the roster up, look at the players that were acquired, both in free agency, in trades, and through the draft, when Mangini and Tannenbaum were the two running the show together. You had the offensive line completely fixed. They drafted Mangold and Ferguson. They were able to go out and get Damian Woody, who Mangini had a big part in recruiting because he knew him from his days with the Patriots. Alan Faneca came in here. They made that brilliant trade for Thomas Jones where all they did was swap second-round picks with the Bears. They were able to get value players like Mike DeVito, an undrafted free agent on the defensive line who made a real impact on the team. Darrell Revis was drafted. David Harris. Even guys in the mid-rounds were contributors. Guys like Leon Washington, Drew Coleman, Brad Smith. You could go on and on down the line. Now, there were misses, certainly. Kellen Clemens didn't turn out to be anything. Although, to be fair, he was a backup in the league for a dozen years, which you could do worse. It's not something you want, ideally, out of a second-round pick, but it's not like he was a complete useless waste of time. You also had the Vernon Golston pick, and there's no real defense for that, even though if you look at who else was picked around there at the time, it made sense. It's still the most disastrous pick in the history of the franchise and one of the worst picks in NFL history, but the core of that team, the guts of that team, Calvin Pace coming in as a free agent, another example, that was built during the Mangini years. So I think that what Rex did was come in here, keep the team elevated, get the fans excited, and there's some value in that for sure. But people get way too nostalgic about Rex Ryan.
Yeah, listen, Rex is another Andy Dalton of coaches. Mm-hmm. Like, Rex came in those first 2 years and had a bunch of success. But as you said, that was with Mangini's roster. Rex's real downfall was in acquiring his own players. Like you said, bringing in Bart Scott and Jim Leonard was good. He got some other things, but he made a bunch of other personnel mistakes. And the thing that really killed that team more than anything else was the offensive line. The offensive line, and I joked around with Damian Woody about this a bunch of times. The first time I made the joke, Damian kind of got a little mad because he thought he mistook me. But I was joking with him, telling him that it was his fault because he decided to retire, and they it saddled the Jets with Wayne Hunter. So I was like, it's all your fault, Damian. I joked around with him a bunch about that. The offensive line fell apart, and then all of a sudden, every flaw as Sanchez was exposed on every play instead of just every once in a while because of the protection from that offensive line. And then it seemed like every move Rex tried to do there just didn't work and blew up in their face, and it fell apart. But if you give Rex a really good roster to work with, it's going to work out pretty well for a while. Players are going to love him. They're going to play really hard for him. But his hand in picking those players and evaluating those players is not good. And then once he has to start building it from scratch himself, he tries, he's one of these guys who's still a little too old school in his mindset. So, and this is another thing that I after the game, this is kind of random tangent, but after the game, we were talking to Jordan Jenkins. Jordan Jenkins made a comment about how they pride themselves on being a stop the run defense first. And that just kind of set alarm bells off in my head. And I was like, it's 2019, we're still doing this. I get it against the Giants with Daniel Jones starting and Saquon Barkley there. I get it there. But 2019, you should really be more worried about stopping a passing game than a running game. But Rex is kind of would have that same mentality too. And it's about toughness, and it's about this. The game has changed, man. There's more finesse to this. There's more explosion to this. And you got to be willing to adapt. And Rex Ryan wasn't willing to adapt. He did very, very poor personnel decisions afterwards. But he came in and he had that success because that roster was ready to win then immediately.
And to add to that, a big part of the downfall was the fact that Rex and Tannenbaum together had the all-in strategy that you were just talking about with Christopher Johnson. They pushed all their chips to the center of the table because they thought they were on the cusp of a Super Bowl. They made a ton of win-now moves that backfired on them in a spectacular way. They were making all kinds of trades with draft picks, giving them away in deals. Tons of premium picks. They were trading up in drafts. They would go into drafts with only 3 draft picks sometimes, and it just did not work out. And the Sanchez gambit really is what killed them, because if Sanchez had turned out to be the quarterback that they were hoping he would be, then we may be having a different discussion. It's very possible that the Jets could have stayed in Super Bowl contention for longer. But because he flamed out and the Jets never replaced the core that Eric Mangini and Mike Tannenbaum had worked to build in the mid-2000s, that's really what led to the downfall. So Rex was fun, no question about it. And the team won for the first 2 years with him, largely based on the talent that was brought in before he got here. But I'm not going to wax too poetic about Rex right now, even though I would much rather have him here than Adam Gase, because at least if Rex were here, you would know that it would never be boring. Next question comes in from Peter Dillard. He says, gentlemen, it's a shame that the Jets don't even have a developmental interior lineman to come in and play for Winters. By the way, just like to point out that, Peter, I love you. Every week it's something about the offensive line, and I respect that because we don't get enough offensive line questions, and it's very important, so I'm glad that you contribute that. He says, thanks, Mac. So what's up with the talent evaluation that Calvin Anderson makes it to a 53-man roster for a team with a better record and better roster than this one? To answer your question, Peter, I honestly don't know what to think about the Calvin Anderson talent evaluation because I wasn't there to watch him in practice. Chris, you might have a different view of this because you were there to watch him, so you could probably talk about this more intelligently than I could. obviously they need as much talent as they can get at the offensive line. And clearly Alan Schechter, your deputy editor, Chris, thinks far more of Calvin Anderson than the Jets did, because he is the president of the Calvin Anderson fan club and was sad to see him go to the Denver Broncos. I would have to assume that if Joe Douglas thought anything of Calvin Anderson, he would have found a way to keep him on the active roster so he wouldn't be poached. But maybe he liked him, was hoping nobody would pick him off, and maybe he could stash him, and it backfired. I'm not really sure. What are your thoughts on Calvin Anderson here, Chris?
Yeah, I first off, I do want to repeat your sentiments about the focus on the offensive line. This is something I always talk about, and I was talking about it with those Rex Ryan years. Fans, people don't like to focus on the offensive line. But the offensive line, and it's harder to do because it's a unit. It's a group of five players. But that's the most important unit. A great offensive line can elevate a bad team, a bad offense, to much better offense. And a terrible offensive line can destroy any semblance of a good offense around them. So it is super important and super critical. And I was banging this drum all the while why Mike Maccagnan was refusing to draft any, why he was going out and signing guys to expensive free agency tags. You have to build the majority of your line through the draft, plug one or two if you can through free agency, but you have to build it through the draft. And it is exceedingly important. Way more important than people want to think about or bother to think about. It is super critical. It is one of the most important things you can do building a football team. As with Calvin Anderson, I didn't see anything from Calvin Anderson that's making me think that they're missing much. Now, granted, especially because of the way these injuries have worked out, sure, it'd be nice to have him back. Or to have some depth, but it also just be nice to get some guys off the street for depth at this point. The offensive line has been so bad. I don't think you're going to be seeing, you know, Calvin Anderson being a starting offensive lineman for a long time in this league. I don't think you're going to be looking and saying Broncos fans are going to be like, what a difference maker Calvin Anderson is. I think it's just in general, this offensive line is just such a mess right now. And it was a mess to start with. And then they've had all types of injuries on top of it. And they had no depth to start. The starters were a mess. The depth was a bigger mess. Then you have injuries to both the starters and the depth. So it's even the biggest mess possible. I don't think Calvin Anderson was going to do anything to save it or make much of a difference there. All I can say is I know and believe that Joe Douglas is going to make upgrading the offensive line a huge priority next year and the year after that. And we'll have to see how much he's able to upgrade it in 1 year. But this is his main priority right now.
Next question comes in from me, and it's about who is going to play this week and who isn't. And for that, we, of course, go to our 35-year orthopedic surgeon, our expert on all things medical, Dr. Steven Stoller, courtesy of Vivid Seats. If you download the Vivid Seats mobile app right now, you can get yourself up to $100 off on your very first purchase when you use the promo code OVERTIME. You may want to use it to do a last-second trip to Washington, D.C. to see the Jets and the Redskins today. Or you may want to use it for something else. Perhaps you want to go see a concert that's coming to town. You want to go see the Radio City Spectacular coming up right around Christmas time. You might want to go to a basketball game or a hockey game. Whatever your heart desires, you can pick yourself up some great tickets on the Vivid Seats mobile app. And right now, if you use the promo code OVERTIME when you sign up, you can get yourself up to $100 off on your very first purchase. Doc, let's talk some injuries this week, and we will start with Brian Winters. Once again, you had this one pegged. You had been saying for months that you thought that Brian Winters was playing with a severe injury. Talk to me about why you thought that, and then tell me about the injury and what the recovery time is going to look like.
Okay, well, the reason why I thought he had an injury is because he's been playing with a shoulder harness, and he's been listed as injured since pretty much preseason. And once he got injured and I was watching during the game with the medical staff attending to him, it looked like his shoulder was out of place, and they were either attempting or successfully able to put it back in place, reducing it. And then the reports came out that he had dislocated his shoulder during the game, and he had dislocated his shoulder in preseason. So that means that he tore the labrum in the front of his shoulder, and that's the reason why he's having the instability, and the brace would prevent his shoulder from going in a position that would make him symptomatic or make his shoulder feel like it's slipping out of place. In other words, protecting it. And, you know, it can only do so much. So apparently his shoulder instability was so bad that it dislocated even with the harness in place. And it's pretty much the same thing that happened to Cashman. And, you know, I'm not saying who's right or wrong, but it might have been the cause of contention between Osemele and, you know, the Jets, you know, coaching and medical staff, because these players had, you know, torn labrums and played with it. But then again, look what happened to them. They ended up where they couldn't finish the season anyway. But I think that's most likely what was going on.
Let's talk about Christopher Herndon. What a disappointing season for him. Gets suspended. Then he comes back, has the injury, doesn't get to play, finally gets in the game. Then he hurts his ribs, and now he's going to be out for the remainder of the season. What's the story with the ribs with Christopher Herndon, and what are we looking at in terms of recovery time? Theoretically, if there were meaningful games late in the season, do you think that Herndon would be able to come back at some point?
Yeah, yeah. You know, a fractured rib takes 4 to 6 weeks to heal. You know, the problem with a fractured rib is that you can't immobilize it. So it's not like you can put it in a splint or a cast or brace it, because you know, the ribs expand when you breathe, and then they contract, you know, when you exhale. So if you know, essentially had to splint it, you restrict your ability to breathe. So basically the treatment is you just treat symptomatically for pain, and it is pretty painful. So every time you take a deep breath, you're going to be reminded you have a fractured rib, and that will probably, you know, go on for, you know, 2 to 3 weeks. They'll treat them with, you know, rest and analgesics, but still, for contact, it takes, you know, 4 to 6 weeks for it to heal. So, you know, if the Jets were in the Super Bowl, I'm sure he could play, but we all know that's not going to happen. So, you know, he'll be out for the season.
Doc, during the Jets-Giants game, you were texting me about Blessing Austin and some good signs that you saw, things that pointed to the fact that he may be in better shape than some people realize coming off of those two ACLs. What did you notice from Blessing Austin that made you optimistic?
Well, for someone, you know, again, who had two ACL surgeries on his knee and who hasn't played for almost 2 years, he came out there, and I didn't see him favoring his leg at all, and I didn't see any kind of problem with his movement. I mean, I was pretty impressed that he was able to, you know, cut and run, you know, quickly, and I didn't see any residual signs of his you know, injury or surgery.
Let's go through the injury report now. We know that CJ Mosley and Ryan Khalil are out. That's been the case for a while. Darrell Roberts is doubtful. We talked about his injury last week. Let's go through the players that are questionable. What do we know about Le'Veon Bell and his potential injury here?
You know, Le'Veon Bell is a little bit of a question for me, because after the game, I see where he was interviewed, and someone asked him how come he didn't play the last couple of plays, and he said that his, you know, ribs were sore, but if he had to, he could have played. But then he was listed where he didn't practice, and then it was limited practice, and limited practice is questionable. But I also read that he had an illness, which was not described, so I don't know if that had anything to do with it. So I think if it was the illness that kept him out, and they just you know, were making it easier for him while he, whatever the illness was, then he should be able to play. Unless his ribs did get sore the day after the game. And that's always a possibility. When there's more swelling in the area, then you're going to have, you know, generally more pain.
I'll go through the rest of these one by one. Let's start with Brandon Copeland.
Brandon Copeland is a hip injury. His thumb injury, whatever it is, could be splinted or taped, and that really shouldn't limit him from playing. His hip, on the other hand, when you get blunt trauma to the hip, where there are a lot of muscles, thick muscles, and in between the muscles, there's a bursa, which is a tissue that allows the muscles to glide over each other without causing friction. And what happens is if you get hit there with blunt trauma and you injure the tissues, the bursa acts similar to like an airbag. So it fills up with blood or it swells, and because it has a lot of nerve endings, it can be very painful. So, you know, I don't know what degree the hip contusion is or the muscle damage, but that would be the limiting factor. But it looks like he had limited practice on Friday, so that would make me more optimistic that he would play.
Henry Anderson.
Henry Anderson's dealing with the same situation now. I guess like Brian Winters, either it's worse than they initially described, because I would think at this point it would almost be a non-issue if it was a grade one AC separation, shoulder separation. So, you know, I would see if he's playing a full game, it's obviously not going to be a problem. But if he is limited, then I would be more concerned and it's something more significant than they originally stated.
It seems like that's the case with Kelvin Beachum, Alex Lewis, Steve McClendon, and Demaryius Thomas too, right? That they've just been nursing injuries. They're playing, but they're going to be listed on the injury report anyway.
Yes, I would definitely say that. You know, Demaryius Thomas, he's been, maybe I'm mistaken, but I think he's been listed with his hamstring since the beginning of the season.
Pretty much every week, Demaryius Thomas has been listed. But one player who hasn't been listed every week, only the last couple of weeks, is Neville Hewitt. He was out for a bit. It looks like there's a chance he may play now. What's the story with Neville Hewitt's injury? And if he doesn't play, is it possible that it's more severe than we originally were led to believe?
Oh, yeah, I would definitely think that. As I mentioned last week, he is a stinger or a burner. And that, you know, is only significant if he's had multiple stingers or burners. If it was a first-time episode, you know, he gets an electric shock that goes down his arm, and as long as there isn't any residual numbness or weakness, then he would be cleared to play. If he's had multiple episodes, then he needs a full evaluation to rule out any structural problems in his cervical spine, you know, such as a congenital narrowing of his spinal canal. If that's the case, then he would be the possibilities of a catastrophic injury would be high, and they would have to tend to that, most likely surgically, or even make a determination that he wouldn't play again. But, you know, I have no reason to believe that that's what's going on unless he doesn't play this week or the next week.
He is a 35-year orthopedic surgeon, our expert on all things medical, and I'm glad that he joins us every week to break down what's going on with the Jets injury-wise. Dr. Steven Stoller, Doc, thanks so much for coming on. For those that want to pick your brain, talk to you about injuries or just stuff involving the Jets or boxing, because you and I are both big boxing fans and we're always open to talking boxing, how can they get a hold of you?
On Twitter, I'm on Steven Stoller, MD, or on The Aging Athlete.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
And that is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal. Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Play like a Jet. Play like a Jet.
Next question comes in from Michael Christopher. He says, when is the last time a team tanked and actually hit it big with a quarterback? We saw Tampa Bay and Tennessee do this with Mariota and Winston. It hasn't seemed to work out. A lot of the problem appears to be that these teams that are tanking end up having really bad offensive lines, so the quarterback that they're tanking for comes in right away, gets beat up, and then in a lot of instances never recovers. Looking at Burrow and Tua right now, do you think that one of them going into these bad situations is already marked for failure? This is what a lot of people think happened to David Carr. It's really difficult to say. I think circumstances play a big role in a quarterback's success, especially their early development. There's no question about it. The problem is that just about any team that has a pick that high, unless it was through a trade or some strange circumstance, it's because their roster is bad and that's why they lost all these games. So it's going to be rough sledding early on for that quarterback, because not only are they getting the quarterback, but they're going to have to build that roster around the quarterback. Now, there are also instances where teams trade up. We saw the Eagles do that. We saw the Rams do that. And in the Eagles' case, they already had a pretty good offensive line, so it made life easier for Carson Wentz from the get-go. But I think what this really boils down to is how good of a job the general manager does finding ways to surround that quarterback with a strong offensive line and good playmakers. Because when the GM is able to do that within a year or two, that's when you see that quarterback do well in the rookie window. There are, of course, other instances where a rookie comes in and does well right off the bat. Russell Wilson is an example of this. But I think that your point is well taken. Unfortunately, I think in a lot of cases, it's pretty tough to avoid because there's a reason that these teams are picking number one.
Yeah, the tanking thing is interesting. As you know, I'm a big Le Batard Show guy, and Mike Ryan, the producer on there, is a big Browns fan, and he's been pointing out all season long with the Dolphins tanking. He's like, this is really weird because everybody points to the Browns as, like, the reason why you should tank. And then the Browns got off to a really bad start, and now people are wondering and questioning if Baker Mayfield was the answer. And there's a ton of talent all around there, so it's kind of weird that they're held up as, like, the standard reason as to why you should tank. But then you look around and, you know, you look at, the Colts. Peyton Manning gets hurt. They get the number one pick. They get Andrew Luck. But that team was such a mess that Andrew Luck retired super early because he got beat up for so long. And this is going to – I heard on the Mina Kimes podcast that this is a little bit of discussion that's starting to percolate now, especially with the Bengals. They're in such bad shape. Does it make sense to grab a quarterback first and then put him in a position behind a terrible offensive line – without a lot of weapons to work with? With the Dolphins are set up a little bit better to do this because of all the other draft picks they've acquired. They can take Tua or Joe Burrow with their first pick, and then they can use all those other picks to build up the offensive line and get a couple weapons. So when you have that many picks, you can go ahead and do that more. But it is an interesting theory here, and they actually mentioned the Seahawks. Now, it was different with the Seahawks. They got Russell Wilson in, third round or whatever. Mm-hmm. So they were able to build stuff around him, build that defense around him, build the offensive line and the Marshawn Lynch with the running game around Russell Wilson to really help him out. You know, and then you look at the Steelers when they had their success with Ben Roethlisberger really young. They didn't draft him with the first overall pick, but they had enough around him that made it worthwhile. So it's an interesting theory or debate amongst yourself, but it just comes down to this, is how much you have to believe in that quarterback. Because I don't care what shape my team is in. This is hindsight knowing what we know now. It would be foolish to pass on Patrick Mahomes no matter what shape your team is in. But it is a balancing act, because if you put Patrick Mahomes on such a terrible team that he can't do anything and then shakes the confidence. You brought up the car example. It's a tricky situation. It depends on how much you believe in the quarterback. But, yes, you do need to put these young quarterbacks in a good position, in a better position. And it can be really tough if you have a team that's completely devoid of talent and you're just sending the young rookie out there. But the tanking thing is interesting. Like I said, everyone's pointing to the Browns is the reason why you should tank. Well, it hasn't really worked out too great for the Browns.
Play like a Jet. Play like a Jet.
Next question comes in for me, and it's about who to bet on this NFL Sunday and even on the Monday Night Football game. And so for that, we bring in our betting lines expert, my brother Craig, professional gambler and professional poker player extraordinaire. And you're going to want to take his tips and bring them over to mybookie.ag, because when you do that, you will get yourself 50% of your first deposit matched when you use the promo code OVERTIME. And you're going to want to use Craig's tips because he's been on a huge roll, 7 winning weeks in a row. We're going to see if it becomes 8. You can use his picks. You can bet some over-unders. You can bet prop bets. Is Le'Veon Bell going to hit 100 yards rushing for the first time this season? Will the Jets actually put a cornerback out on the field that anybody's ever heard of? Probably not, so you might want to bet no on that one. All that and a whole bunch more when you sign up over at mybookie.ag. Remember, your first deposit will get matched up to 50%. The max is $1,000, so $2,000, you'll get $1,000. Anything below that, they'll match up to 50% of your first deposit. Mybookie.ag, you play, you win, and you get paid. And with that, we bring in Craig. How's everything going, Craig? How was your staycation last week?
Hey, what's up, Scott? It was good, man. It was good. It was nice to, you know, get a little alone time before the baby's born. We saw some Michael Jackson one, then another Cirque du Soleil show. So it was good. It was good. We had a good time. And once again, more importantly, another winning week, 7 in a row. And, I mean, at this point, you know me, I'm not an arrogant guy, but I think you're just missing out on money if you don't put these picks in at mybookie.ag. So I would get them in. I would get them in this week, and I'm feeling real confident with this week's pick. So I'm ready to go.
Knock on wood, let's hope that this is the 8th straight winning week. Who's your first pick?
All right, my first pick, I really like this one. You might think it's a little crazy, but Buffalo has been on a little downslide lately. Miami, I know they suck, but I like them here. Division game, +6.5 at home. Miami, +6.5 at home versus Buffalo. I think if they keep it close, wouldn't even be surprised if they win the game. I think it'll be a close game, though. I like Miami, +6.5 versus Buffalo at home.
Picking a game involving a division rival for the New York Jets right off the bat, I love it. What's your second pick this week, Craig?
All right. My second pick is probably, in my opinion, the best and most intriguing game of the week. I'm going to go with the Texans +4 at Baltimore. Tough game, but, you know, to me, pretty even teams. I know they're on the road, but I like Texans getting the 4 points here. Again, I see a very close game. I think this one's really a toss-up, so I like Texans +4.
Battle of two of the best young quarterbacks in the league right now. I like that extra point, because if it's 3 points, I'm not so sure. The 4 points makes me think that it's a solid bet, because if the Texans can at least come within a field goal, which I think there's a good chance they will, and you'll be able to cash out with that one. Who do you like for your third pick this week, Craig?
All right, so my third pick here is going to be the Monday Night Football game. I like San Diego +4 at home versus Kansas City. Again, tough game, division game. I know San Diego's been a little on and off this year. Same with Kansas City, though. You know, Mahomes is starting to get his groove back a little bit, but I like San Diego +4 at home in a Monday night division game. Crowd's going to be loud. I like San Diego to win the game outright, but I like San Diego +4.
What about the Jets, Craig? Who do you like in that game?
That game, honestly, I like Washington -2.5. I know it's sad to say. I mean, the Jets are both miserable teams, but I'll take Washington at home. God, I can't even imagine sitting down to watch that one miserable game, but I'll go with Washington.
So those are your individual picks, Craig, but what about the teaser? Who do you have this week?
So this week I'm going to do something I haven't done yet. I always go with one team that I do my individual picks in the teaser. This week, I'm just going to double it down. I've been so hot with my regular picks. why not? Figured I'll go with two of my regular picks and put them in the teaser as well. So I'm going to go Texans plus 11 against Baltimore and Chargers plus 11 versus Kansas City. So doubling down on my regular picks, going to put them both in the teaser. That's how confident I am this week with those picks. So just going to ride it out.
A bold move by Craig, but why not? He's been on a roll lately, so knock on wood, let's hope that that roll continues. Craig, thanks again for coming on. Really appreciate it. You broke my heart by telling me that you were recording this and then going to get Pizza Hut pizza. As somebody who's from New York, it makes me sad. I know you're in Vegas now, but still, if Pizza Hut's the best you can do, I guess that means that I can probably never move to Las Vegas. But besides eating Pizza Hut pizza, Craig, what have you got going on coming up, and how can people get a hold of you if they want to pick your brain on gambling, sports, poker, anything else?
So, you can send me an email, cmace86@aol.com, or message me on Facebook at Craig Mason. Like I said, getting closer and closer. We're maybe going to be due in about 3 weeks, so just getting ready, getting all the car seats and strollers and all that stuff ready, but other than that, that's pretty much it.
Thanks, Craig. Talk to you next week. Now let's get back into the mailbag. Next question comes in from Will at NotSince69. He says, gentlemen, in light of Christopher Johnson's endorsement of Gase, do you guys feel less confident or down on Joe Douglas, considering or assuming he must have given his endorsement of Gase to Christopher Johnson to keep this going? I said from the beginning that Gase and Douglas were going to be tied together at least temporarily. Gase was the one that recommended Douglas for the job, so even if Gase isn't necessarily pulling the strings, Douglas is still going to feel some sort of loyalty to him, especially when you consider the circumstances that have gone down this season with all the injuries, Sam Darnold in the mono, all the other craziness that's happened around this team. I would imagine that Joe Douglas probably told Christopher Johnson when asked about it that he and Adam need another year to implement the system and to go out and get the players they want and so on and so forth. I don't know this for a fact. You might, Chris, you might have better intel than I do. I don't think anything different of Douglas, though, because I expected that. I just hope that he lives up to the reputation that he has around the league and is able to rebuild this roster in a way that, as we keep saying, allows Adam Gase to be Andy Dalton, so that if they replace Gase, good. Maybe they get an actual coach that's top of the line, and if they don't, maybe they can work around Gase's inefficiencies and still be a good team because of the talent. I don't think any less or more of Douglas than I did before because, as I said, this is exactly what I thought was going to happen.
Yeah, this doesn't change my feelings on Douglas at all. I know everyone was going crazy about what Christopher Johnson said. There was two main problems I had with what Christopher Johnson said and did. And one of them is just a reinforcement of a problem that has been a problem for years, for multiple years. The first problem is come out and say you're not firing him now. But don't sit here at 2-7 after just beating the miserable Giants, sit here and say he's coming back next year no matter what. Don't do that. There's no reason to do that. Just give him the whole season and let him evaluate afterwards. But especially with all the off-the-field medical stuff and all these other things, the way players are reacting to him, it's just silly to sit there and say he's coming back next year no matter what. The other problem is when he was asked about, Jamal and wanting Jamal to be here, he deferred to Joe Douglas. But he's not deferring to Joe Douglas with the head coach because the head coach reports to the Johnsons and the GM reports to the Johnsons. And this is the structure that the Jets have had forever. And this is and it's a big problem. The GM should be the one making all these calls. Joe Douglas knows way more about what it takes to run a smart football operation than the Johnsons do, so he should be the one making all these calls. I'm not sure. I don't think that Joe Douglas, if he had that full authority, I don't think he would fire Gase after the season right now, but I know he does not have that full authority. So I can't say that he wouldn't do that, that he wouldn't look after the season and say, yeah, we really need to move on. I can't say that. I know that to be true. What I do know to be true is the Johnsons do not want to be paying three coaches next year. What I do know to be true is the Johnsons were not about to cave to public pressure and planes and flying banners again for a second time. They're not about to sit here and say, oh, every time these guys get mad and angry and fly a plane with a banner somewhere, we're just going to do what they say. They're not about to let give this impression off that they're being run by people flying banners around the city. So all the, you know, back and forth about that, all I know is that definitely did not help their case, because if anything, it forces the Johnsons to dig in more and say, definitely not firing him now, because we are not going to make it seem like we're just listening to the fans on a whim and just this one group of fans flies a banner and we're just going to do whatever they say every single time. But this is a Johnson problem more than it's Joe Douglas problem. And he's not going to do that at this point. And Joe Douglas does not have the authority to do that at this point. So I don't think he's going to sit here and rock any boats about it. We'll see how the rest of the season plays out again, especially with the inside the locker room and everything out there. But I would guess that Joe Douglas will be fine rolling with him for next year. But then if next year goes anything like this year, then I would think that he will sit there and go to Johnson saying, yeah, we need to make this move now.
To add to your point, Chris, I think another element of this is the fact that the press conference that Christopher Johnson held was fine up until the point where he said that Gase was going to be here in 2020 no matter what. I thought everything else made plenty of sense, the stuff that he said, the injuries and that you're not going to make a rash decision and so on and so forth. You can agree or disagree, but at least it made sense. Once he got to the point where he was saying that Adam Gase is going to be here no matter what in 2020, that's when I think he went a bridge too far, and there was no reason for him to jump to that, because as you said, Chris, he puts himself in a position now where either Gase is going to have to do really, really well down the stretch, or he's going to do really poorly and Christopher Johnson will either have to change his mind and look silly that way, or hang on to Gase and endure even more anger and look even worse because you guaranteed the job security of a coach who, say, goes 2-14 or 3-13, and let's say Darnold doesn't do well, the nightmare scenario. You don't want to be in that position. There was no need to do that. It made no sense. And it just seemed to me to be a lot of that false bravado that we were talking about before with Adam Gase, the sort of, you're not going to tell me what to do. He's going to be here because I said so. It was just not necessary. I get what he was going for, but he would have been much better off just stopping and saying they're not going to do anything in season. They don't make rash decisions. Any kind of major decision wouldn't get talked about until after the season anyway, and left it at that. Last question comes in from Scott M. He says, the cast of Justified is going to be reuniting at a panel at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas next year. Are you booking the tickets to go to this, Chris, or am I? Who's Scott M? Oh, yeah, that's me.
I am looking up how to get tickets for this right now as we speak. I did not know about this, and I guess I have to go down to Austin, Texas, because, yes, I need to be involved in this.
I need a picture with Nick Searcy, and also if I get anywhere near Erica Tazel, you're going to have to pull me away because I like her too much.
All right, so we're going to have to just fight now. So yeah, just get this out of the way now. Fight now, and then the winner can go down to Austin alone.
I also need a picture with both Timothy Oliphant and Walton Goggins. I want to be in between the two of them so that on one side of me is Boyd and the other side of me is Raylan. That is the ultimate picture for a Justified fan. But I also do need a picture with Nick Searcy, who played Art, who was far and away my favorite under-the-radar sneaky character on that show.
Yeah, absolutely. I had not heard about this, but I need this in my life. I absolutely am all about this. So yes, please do this. And then I need to try to talk my way into talking them into doing like an extra season or a movie or something, because I'm all about it.
I say we pitch them on a movie in which Boyd and Raylan team up to go after Christopher Johnson for ownership of the Jets to try and fix things the Kentucky way.
There you go. I like it. Just show the Johnsons what Harlan County's all about.
That's right. We do things the Harlan way around here. See, we end the mailbag on a positive note, Chris. Thanks so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. I know you've got a ton up at jetsinsider.com. Even though I fined you $40,000, you still found a way to afford to publish some stuff up on the website. What do you got up there?
Yeah, well, I'll have something up later. Just kind of an overall overview of everything that's going on with the Quincy stuff, the Christopher Johnson stuff. So I'll have a bunch of stuff on all this. Obviously, I'll have stuff on the game on Sunday, playing Washington. So, you know, there's one of those things. This with Dwayne Haskins starting, everything I've heard about how he's not ready, this should be a game the Jets win comfortably. If they don't, then we're going to have to, you know, drag up some of that the old stuff before the Giants game. So we'll have to wait and see. Because, again, Christopher Johnson came out and said that Adam Gase is safe. And I believe him, and I think he's going to stick with that no matter what. But if these problems keep showing up and if they keep looking bad against teams like Washington, I'm not going to ease up on my criticism. You know, there's a difference between beat writers sitting there acknowledging that a coach isn't going to get fired and just rolling with it and defending it, and then acknowledging that he's not getting fired but still pointing out everything that's bad about it. So I will continue to do that, and we will see how this goes. But I am not going to shy away from criticizing it when it needs to be. And I think I've proven this, anybody that's followed me, even since the Rex days, when I was like, there was enough stuff about Rex Ryan that was bad that you didn't need to create stuff to make it bad. So there'll be times where I see Adam Gase get criticized for something and I think it's a ridiculous criticism, and I'll defend that point. But that won't mean that I'm going to defend him overall. And as long as things keep looking bad and seeming bad, I will continue to call that out, whether there is hope of him being fired or not.
Go ahead and follow Chris on Twitter at CNimbly and at Jets Insider. Read his very big deal work at jetsinsider.com. Follow his deputy editor, the president of the Calvin Anderson Fan Club, Alan Schechter, at Alan_SCHECHTER. And for the latest and greatest, the New York Jets podcast, you know where to go. That's Turn on the Jets Digital and turnonthejets.com.